This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org. On today's Farm and Garden Show with J. Allison Moscariello and Bill Taylor, we dive into successfully growing apples and other fruit in New England with Joe Pappas, who works at Risca Brook Orchard in Sandusfield. First, a few upcoming events. BerkshireGrown.org is the place to find information on all the local farmers markets. The Great Barrington Seed Library needs a coordinator to revive this community resource. Contact the Great Barrington Public Library at 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Once again, 413-528-1619, extension 6000.
This is our planet, the one that we all share. Let us remember that all life breathes the air. Our world is sacred, its future in our trust.
Joe Pappas is orchard manager at Risca Brook Orchard in Sandusfield. He's a lifelong orchardist, having worked on many orchards, large and small, across the Northeast, including in Massachusetts, Vermont, New York, and New Hampshire for the last 15 years or so. What brought you to learning about integrated pest management?
It was more just through working on so many orchards over so many years. It's the norm of growing fruit nowadays, so I started actually learning about it at a very young age when I was in high school, first working on an orchard, seeing an IPM consultant come in who's a professional entomologist, and at the start of it, I had this basic understanding that, oh, there's bugs in the orchard that somebody comes and counts and gives us recommendations of what to do. And then from there, as my career furthered along, when I started working at larger and larger farms, I became a direct part of that. When we did in-house IPM programs in Vermont and New York. With that being said, there are people who are professional consultants, who are trained entomologists, who do this for a living, who do consulting for orchards, and I am not one of those people. I've gained my knowledge just through pure experience over the years, through work.
Did you go to school in agriculture?
Yes. I went to UVM. My major was in the College of Agriculture, but it was more towards a small agricultural business. It was kind of the agronomics major that they revamped. So no official degree in entomology, but everything has meshed together and related over the years between understanding the unfortunate economic side of farming coupled with the decisions that we try to make as best management practices in our orchards. So,
have you discovered any of those lovely insects that we sometimes call pests to be edible?
I have never had the inclination to say when I check my traps to see what they taste like, but I know that they are a potential source of protein. So, no, but I'm sure that it's a possibility.
Well, you know, the only reason I ask is because we had a very curious and wonderful, adventurous entomologist, Dr. Janine Pfeiffer, who was always sticking bugs in her mouth and checking things out. I remember she wasn't particularly happy with aphids.
Right.
She thought they tasted pretty bad.
Well, they were probably what they were eating. It's probably what they were eating, too.
A ladybug might have a different opinion on that.
Yeah, exactly. A ladybug might really differ that.
So you learned this on the job at different farms. Where
I would say definitely the core of my sustainable mindset comes from my experience in Vermont. I worked at a very large commercial orchard that supplied fruit to the entire state of Vermont, as well as upstate New York, parts of New Hampshire. And we were an eco grower, very sustainably minded on a very large scale, which was really exciting to be a part of. So that was kind of a whole new world for me when I went back up there to work, when I was just thrown into the ring and learned a lot of things very, very quickly, especially in the IPM world. I worked with a really, really good orchard manager who taught me a lot. My experience there definitely was a big turning point that helped me realize that you can make decisions that have sustainability in mind that work on a very large scale. A lot of the stuff is not just applicable to very, very small farms. Granted, there's a large
variation.
Would you
say that louder? Because there's a lot of people who would argue with you. I agree, because people like Michael Phillips have proven that you can do things
There's a caveat, though. Obviously, that's a very broad statement.
No, but it's a good statement.
With growing
people
fruit,
need to hear.
There's so many pests and so many diseases that one small-scale solution that may work for a small 50-tree backyard orchard may work for a 15-acre orchard. It may not work for a 300-acre orchard.
Right.
There are solutions for other pests. Scab is one that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. Sanitation practices that work very well on a large scale and a small scale. And that's part of IPM, is having a very innate understanding of everything you're trying to control in an orchard. Every pest, and pest meaning insect, disease, bacteria, fungal pathogens, and everything that you do, whether it's large decision or a small decision to try to control a pest, you've got to understand every action has reactions and consequences. So on a large scale, when you make those decisions, the effects can be obviously very large. Playing around with that stuff is a lot of fun. I'm very happy to be at a much smaller sized orchard, still very big, where I can try to apply some of those practices that I think may not have worked on 200 or 300 acres, that may work much better at an orchard the size of Risca.
How big are they?
I think we're growing about 20 or 30 acres of mm-hmm. apples.
Yeah.
We just plant an acre of blueberries. We just planted about a half acre of peaches, which I'm really excited about.
Oh, yeah. How do you monitor your pests?
There's some of my traps here. As you can see, there's two traps in front of us, which
yes.
are two very unique different objects. One is a plastic cardboard, I would say, like a corrugated cardboard.
Looks like a tent.
Looks like a tent, right. Yeah. About the size of a sheet of paper. And then the other one is a round sphere on a hook that hangs into the tree. So these are for two very different pests. So you monitor for different pests in different ways.
Okay.
It's not a broad spectrum kind of thing.
No one and done.
Exactly, not at all. And these are only a couple of what we use. So
right. The
tent style structure, we put a pheromone lure on the inside and a sticky board on the inside with a grid. You can use different types of pheromone lures to attract different insects. So like this trap I use for coddling moth.
We're looking at the tent right
the tent,
now.
Yep.
Yes.
So I have, like, for example, right now, there's one for coddling moth, one for a bleak-banded leaf roller. In the peach orchard, eventually there will be similar traps for oriental fruit moth. And then, in comparison, the round sphere gets
deployed.
Looks
a little sticky.
It's very sticky. It is coated in stuff that it's very hard to get off your fingers. Bugs obviously don't like it, but this is for apple maggot fly later in the season.
Wow.
I've actually got out in the orchard right now. A fun fact, this is actually developed by the late Ron Procopy from UMass Amherst, who was a true pioneer in real IPM tactics. He developed a lot of the IPM monitoring systems that we use today, including this. And this is really interesting because you can use this baited or non-baited with a pheromone lure, which affects the threshold trap counts, consequently, which we can talk about in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Because apple maggot flies are attracted to the visual piece, the large red ripe apple. They're not attracted to unripe apples, so the large red sphere represents a ripe apple.
Sure.
And then the pheromone lure for this is not actually a pheromone lure. It's, I call it that, but it's a apple essence lure.
Sure, they would smell it and they're going to go for it.
Exactly. It mimics the ethylene given off by a ripening apple, mm-hmm. and they're attracted to it. Two different traps for a few very different pests that we're monitoring for. There's another pest called San Jose scale. The young nymphs are little tiny crawlers. They just crawl up the bark of the tree. They find a place and they set down and make a coating.
Would you say that again? What are they called again?
San Jose scale.
San Jose scale, and they crawl up the bark.
Yep, they crawl up the bark, and then when they find a place to feed, I think of it as putting down roots. It's not the correct term. Entomologists will hate me for that. But and then they form a waxy coating to protect themselves.
And meanwhile, they're eating away the bark.
Exactly, yeah. They can severely affect the health of trees.
They get into the cambium.
Exactly,
yeah.
And they really can do a lot of damage. And they can also affect fruit if the problem is severe enough. So San Jose scale, the way we monitor for them is we try to monitor the amount of crawlers that are emerging. And we just take black electrical tape, wrap it backwards around the limb so the sticky side faces out, coat it with some Vaseline. And that has to be deployed at just the right time when our pest forecasting models are saying San Jose scale is now hatching, the eggs are hatching, the nymphs are crawling. Check your traps, check your tape, count them, see what you find.
How'd you get that forecast?
Great question.
I'm going to interject just on a small scale. If you have three or four trees, I've read that you can use these traps
For control.
Correct.
On a larger orchard, you'd have to buy so many traps, it wouldn't be cost effective. But on a, just if you have just a few trees, you can get some of these traps.
Absolutely.
And improve the quality of your fruit.
Same thing with apple maggot, with these spheres, especially if you baited them with the apple essence lure. There's actually a new technique I really want to try next year for apple maggot, where they're actually starting to coat the spheres with spinosad. I believe it's an organic insecticide. I could be wrong.
What's it called?
I think so.
Spinosad. Instead of spraying something for apple maggot fly, you deploy a certain number of these traps and a certain density throughout the orchard that have that insecticide. The flies are drawn to the trap, and it's called an attract and kill method, which is becoming more common and more popular.
Which is fantastic because you're not messing up any of the,
exactly.
the environment.
And it's, exactly. It's specific to that species. Everything is dependent on your pest pressure.
Okay.
And it takes a whole season to really get to know what you're dealing with in an orchard.
Yep.
So this is my first growing season at Risca. So a lot of these techniques I would have liked to have deployed this year right off the bat, but unless you know what your pressure is, you don't know if what you're gonna do is going to be effective. So say for apple maggot fly, if the pressure is off the charts historically, you may not want to try that right away. It can be very expensive, and if it's very expensive and you deploy it and it still doesn't work, then you're really in a tricky situation, and you've really got to take more of an action than you could have originally done from the get-go. Same thing with coddling moth. I'm finding that the coddling moth pressure at Risca is a lot lower than I had anticipated coming here, which is really exciting.
That's terrific.
Yeah, so next season on my radar is to try true mating disruption for coddling moth, which I've done in the past. Works very well. I saw it knock down some of the highest pressure blocks that I've ever seen the following season using mating disruption. Really, really.
How do you do that? What is the key for that? But by the way, I have to interject.
Sure.
For our listeners, this apple, this round sticky thing, I thought that Joe was bringing us a candied apple. That's how good it looks.
That's exactly what it looks like.
It looks like a dirty candied apple because he's got some bugs on there, but I was still, my mouth was watering. And I'm not a bug, but well, actually my last name is Muscariello. It means little fly, so there you go.
Maybe you have an affinity for this particular.
I definitely do. It had me going.
Yep.
So mating disruption.
So I think of mating disruption as, think about how humans put on cologne to try to attract each other, a concept which is lost on me, but that's, you know, works for some people. So insects aren't much different. They released pheromones to try to find each other, and they mate, lay eggs, or have whatever this particular species does. And this is not an entirely new thing, but mating disruption now, instead of using the sex pheromones to attract the particular species to our traps, we're figuring out that we can make stronger lures that are ridiculously strong with this pheromone, and we place them at a certain density throughout the entire orchard at a very particular time, again based off of our forecasting models, and the entire orchard is flooded with this pheromone. So when the males and females are trying to find each other, they can't. It's literal confusion. And if they can't find each other and mate, they can't reproduce, and the next generation really naturally takes care of itself, dies off. You're not using a toxin.
Fantastic.
You're not killing an insect. You're not spraying anything. It's a really, really wonderful thing.
I love it.
It's awesome. There are mating disruption lures now.
Can we do that with humans?
Boy, that would be a concept, huh?
I'm thinking of a few places I'd like to deploy that.
Yes. It's a really great concept. It's something that I'm really excited about.
Yeah.
And like I said, it's something that I think a lot of the large-scale growers at first were very skeptical about because it's not necessarily cost-effective. I think the cost is coming down. It's becoming more widely used. And it works. And it's pretty easy to deploy. The lures are these like 6-inch long black rubber strips with a hole at the top. There's different types, but that's one of them. Comes with a special hanger. And you have to position these at a certain spot within the tree canopy based on the size and density of the tree. So say in a semi-dwarf orchard like Risca's, the lures would go in the top half of the canopy in the outer third of the diameter.
How many per tree?
You have a density per acre that you deploy them and you go across the whole orchard. And then on the side of the orchard where the prevailing wind comes from, you bait that side at double the density. So which is typically the west side in New England. So on the west side of any given orchard block, you put out a line on the edge of double the amount of lures so that as the wind comes in, it blows more pheromones across the block to keep that flood of pheromones consistent across the whole orchard.
That's fantastic.
It's a fascinating concept.
Yeah, it is, totally. Wow. And I love it because...
And it works.
Yeah.
No trapping, it's just those pheromones.
Well, this is something that I am still not clear on. I still get very confused, like the insects. Say you coat the entire orchard in pheromones to confuse coddling moth. So how do you monitor after that? There's many, many different types of lures that you can buy at different strengths that last for different amounts of time. Mm-hmm. Some attract just males, some attract just females, some attract two different species. There's all sorts of stuff. Say we use mating disruption next year, I've got to know that I can't use the same lures that I put in this year. I have to use the lures that are significantly stronger to overcome the orchard flooding lures because I still need to monitor what's going on. Because if things get out of control, I don't want to risk the entire crop in one season. I want to know that it's working, which can get a little bit tricky. Monitoring is a really, really important part of any orchardist job and very important in IPM because you've really got to have this constant monitoring and understanding of what's going on in the orchard across the board. Beneficials, pests, what's in bloom, fungal pathogens, all happening all at the same time.
What kind of an effect does it have on the beneficials?
So say
and are they inured to this because it's not their pheromone?
Exactly. It doesn't affect beneficials.
Fantastic.
It's particular to that species in most part. I think there's a couple that will attract both. I forget what they are, but in that case, they're both pests. It's fascinating. It's really interesting. So it kind of takes the concern for hurting beneficial and really alleviates that worry. Because that's a huge concern, including pollinators.
Of course.
I mean, that's kind of the driver.
I do remember the yellow sticky traps, which sometimes track good guys,
right? Those are to monitor a couple different species, because those are just plain old sticky boards, not baited. So that's just to see...
Who's out there.
Exactly. Yeah. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm.
So how long have you been with Risca?
This is my first season there. I just started here in April.
Where were you before?
I was in central Massachusetts. The last 4 years I worked at about the same size orchard, actually, really small, pick your own, retail based, very, very wonderful, simple, low key place, working for a wonderful couple. And I got the chance to come out here and manage the orchard out here. I have some friends who live in the Berkshires and I jumped at the opportunity.
What a great deal.
It's really wonderful working for the owners of Risca and doing this with them. Versus most of my career, I've worked for other lifelong orchardists, and there can be conflict over, especially with more progressive growing tactics. Other folks are not as eager to try things out of fear of risking the crop. But in our situation, we're trying to sell everything direct to consumer, whether it's retail, farm stands, farm markets. So we have a better understanding that we're willing to risk a little bit of the crop if it means having a more environmentally friendly, safer way to control pests.
Fantastic. I was going to ask about pre-health sprays.
Yes, there are very particular nutrients that go on as foliar sprays at very particular times of the year. There's a few that go on right around bloom or just after bloom to feed the forming flowers and also the formation of next year's buds that help them be more frost resilient, helps the current flowers be more hardy to a potential freeze, as well as trying to boost the tree's immune system for the incoming onslaught of
Are we talking scat. Neem or a combination?
No, I would like to try neem. I'm a little scared of phytotoxicity that I've heard, and I don't know what the current rate would be, because like with anything, if neem is most effective at 10 gallons to the acre, that's a lot of neem oil to put
in. It is a lot.
But if it works, if it's practical and feasible and it works...
So what do you use?
I've been using three different mixes of boron, zinc, and a foliar nitrogen that goes on... I think all three are liquids. No, the zinc was I used a granular this year. That go on just in the sprayer as a foliar. And then this time of the year, I'm using a calcium carbonate every 14 to 20 days that I'm putting out because growing fruit needs a lot of calcium this time of year.
Right.
But calcium is not very mobile in the tree. It does not move very far. What you have in the tree is what you've got.
Doesn't boron help the calcium use, though, isn't it? There's a synergy.
Yes.
So that's why you do the boron, but then you sometimes have to do calcium also, right?
Yes, and the boron is most effective earlier in the season. Mm-hmm. It typically goes on early. There's reasons why I think we're not supposed to apply it this late in the season to synergize with the calcium, but I'm a little foggy on that. But the calcium carbonate is also going on now in part because it controls sunburn on apples, a problem that we've never had in the past. That's becoming an increasing problem.
It was in California. We had brown black apples.
I can't imagine. And there's other sunblock products that are in use out in the West Coost I've heard of now.
So boron strengthens like the cells, and so it's probably good for the stems. That's why you probably would put it on earlier.
The stems and the forming pollen and the forming tubes. The most sensitive time of year in an orchard is when the flowers are all open, being pollinated, which is when they're prone to damage like we had last year. The big frost that we lost a lot. So the more you can build up those cell walls and make them stronger and more immune to a cold snap in the middle of the night, the more apt you are to have a better crop. And it's very, very apparent in trees that have nutrient deficiencies that are not as healthy. They tend to drop fruit a lot easier. The flowers, it's called blossom blast. The flowers literally just dry up and go away. So nutrient balance and management is important. It's something that I'm still learning a lot about. It's a fascinating world. As a grower, you always have to be learning. You can't just learn the way to do something and do that the rest of your life.
It's absolutely
not, it's not feasible. So
because especially with everything changing.
Mm-hmm. Yep, big time.
And I imagine you must love the fruit, or you wouldn't even be in it.
I eat an apple a day. In the fall, it's considerably more than that.
I'm sure. Our big craziness is apple crisp. Can't wait to have those in the oven. Based on this past year, and we're going to lead to that next question, do you feel that the orchard got, and I know you started in April, you have a sense of the area, do you feel that the apples and the fruit, the trees have gotten enough chill hours to have a good crop this year? Is that what you're seeing? What are you seeing?
Things are looking very good right now. Knock on wood. We are not out of the woods yet. We are never out of the woods until the fruit is being picked.
Right.
We've had a really good season. Weather-wise, in the spring, things worked in our favor for the most part. We had a pretty easy year scab pressure-wise. We only had a couple big fire blight scares that we had to worry about. And the crop itself is looking very good, meaning there were no major events that really froze anything off, no major unforeseen, I think the crop insurance companies call them acts of God.
Right.
Exactly. Coming off of last year, this has been a real treat, especially for the orchards that really lost everything last year in southern Vermont, some of the other higher elevations that lost quite a bit. In terms of when things will be ripe, I have a rough guess. It's very interesting at risk is because we're so high up elevation-wise. We're at 1,600 feet. So when I talk to other growers in New England, my friends back east in the central part of the state are about 7 to 10 days ahead of Riscas. So I've been more staying in touch with friends in southern Vermont because we're a little bit more on par season-wise. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that coming here. And it's kind of a nice treat because it's a little bit cooler here. It feels like it's a little bit drier too. And it's just very pleasant. It makes the season a little bit shorter. So in terms of when things will be ready is when the seeds turn brown, when they're ripe. they're ready. Probably the first week of September.
That's what I hope. Hoping for it.
Well, I want to ask about the weather station before we get into climate. You have a weather station. Could you talk about you have to spray at just the right time? How accurate are those models? Number of degree days of hot, of warm or cold? Say a little bit about how
it's
you use the
weather. It's called ambient weather.
So we have a weather station that it's like any other weather station for somebody that wants to monitor what's going on in the weather atmosphere. Ours in particular is tied to an agricultural disease prediction network that Cornell came out with, I don't know when, 10 or 15 years ago, called NUWA, the Network for Environment and Weather Applications. And Cornell developed these prediction models for a lot of what we try to control. When the eggs hatch, when the crawlers are happening for San Jose scale, it predicts scab ascospore infection events. It predicts fire blight infection events, which is all based on, like you said, Bill, the degree days. The models basically count and accumulate degree days, which all have different bases. Degree day base 45 is different than degree day base 55 because it's unique for every single model. So there's so many moving pieces and so many variables. We are able to understand so much more about everything we're trying to do thanks to these models. And we are relying on them a lot, rightfully so. They're not always completely accurate, especially with fire blight. There's two different main models that we use, and most growers have access to both, and we take the readings of both and sometimes take the average because sometimes the two fire blight models are in completely different predictions, which is very frustrating because fire blight is something that we really do not want to mess around with.
Can you talk a little bit about fire blight?
Sure.
What it is?
So
what
fire
it looks
blight
like.
is probably one of the most detrimental pests, and I call it a pest because it, like anything else, to orchardists. It's a bacteria, Erwinia malivora. Somebody will correct me on the pronunciation. It is everywhere all at once out in the orchard. It thrives in hot, wet conditions, but it only enters an apple tree via open blossoms. It can enter through soft tissue injury, leaf cuts from magic ice storm. It is really detrimental to tree health because if it enters the blossom during those perfect events, it can run rampant through a tree and kill a whole tree in a year.
What does it look like?
So it's called fire blight because it turns the new vegetative shoots. Well, let me backtrack for a second. It enters via the blossoms. The symptoms of infection don't show up for about 2 weeks after infection, after the tree has started to grow vegetative shoots, and those vegetative shoots begin to curl on the ends, and then it literally looks like somebody takes a flamethrower and just roasts that whole vegetative shoot, and it begins to move down through the tree from either the blossom's infection site or what's called shoot blight, again, the trauma infection event. And it's really tricky because it can get out of control very, very quickly. It's the kind of thing that as soon as you see it in an orchard, you've got to cut it below the infected tissue into healthy tissue. If you miss that spot, it will just continue to race through a tree.
That's horrible.
It's really awful. Consequently, again, it really favors hot, moist weather. So you need to have ambient temperatures above 65, I believe, and then what we consider a wedding event, which is not just rain. It could be a heavy, heavy morning dew during bloom, which is, we believe, last year there was, on top of the real kicks to the gut last year, was there was a massive fire blight infection event that hit a lot of growers in central Massachusetts that everybody missed all at once. The models didn't forecast it. It was controllable, but not ideal. And a lot of us kind of looked back at, again, the weather data collected by the stations.
Wow.
And we figured that there was a really heavy dew one morning that had burned off before a lot of us woke up. And the reason I want to talk more about fire blight is because if you talk to the previous generation of lifelong orchardists, fire blight was never a concern back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, for a couple of reasons. The cultivars they were growing were not as susceptible, just the simple DNA of every variety. Every variety responds differently. Some varieties will get fire blight every year without fail. It's just in their nature, and some varieties are just about immune to it. So a lot of the modern varieties that we're now planting, some of the new...
Like Gallas and the Pink Lady.
Pink Ladies are very susceptible. Mm-hmm. It's a late apple, so it blooms late. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the reason it's susceptible. The flowers are open later in the spring when it gets hotter and more moist. Mm-hmm. The varieties that run earlier, when the flowers are open earlier, when it's more cool, below 65, it's usually not an issue. And again, by the nature of the tree, coupled with the fact that, yes, we're having more common warmer wedding events in the spring than we had in the past. And it's, even in my short career so far, it has become very apparent at how much it's increasing, and it's becoming a huge concern, especially in a lot of modern orchards where the trees are grafted to fully dwarfing rootstock, so the overall tree is smaller, so the less tissue that the bacteria needs to infect, the quicker it can move through the tree and kill the whole tree.
So I'm an orchardist. I have a dozen trees just because I started out small, and it's my first season, and I'm having this acquaintance with fire blight, but I was lucky because the 12 trees I had were reasonably, let's say, a foot diameter at least. Mm-hmm. What are my chances when I first notice that fire blight occurring? What would I be doing? Would I be cutting off the limb and into the cambium? I'm going that deep into it?
Well, you have to cut the limb off. You're cutting through the cambium through the whole branch, right?
Right, yep. But am I cutting into the actual trunk too? Am I going that far?
So the going, and this has actually changed over the years.
Okay.
The best management practices, as soon as you see an infected shoot, and they can pop up overnight, it's very quick. And as soon as you see that, you look at the shoot, and often there's actual bacterial ooze that comes out of the shoots and the infected leaves. It's gross. And you look all the way down to where the infection stops, where you see healthy leaves again, and then you go about 16 to 18 inches farther into healthy tissue, and then you cut there. It doesn't matter where it is. If it's the trunk of the tree, you cut the tree in half. It doesn't matter because that bacteria is moving through the tree. It's already in healthy tissue below where you see visible infected tissue. So you've got to anticipate that it's already a good 6 to 8 or 10 inches below where you see the infection stop, and then you've got to go beyond that. I've cut out fire blight in the past, and you go back 2 days later, and the leaves were below where you cut are infected. You go, oh, geez, now you got to keep cutting and keep cutting. It's tricky, especially in young trees are where it's a real problem, because it can kill a young tree when it's 2-3 years old, like that.
And when you cut that off, what do you do with that material?
The school of thought on that has differed over the years. Right now, you can actually just leave it out on the ground, not under the tree, but out in the direct sun, and that bacterial ooze will dry up. Because fire blight, I think of it as a parasite, it needs a living host to keep producing and thrive. So as long as you lay it out in the sun, not near the tree, and it dries up, you're okay. The old school of thought was that you had to physically remove it from the orchard and take it out. And in that process, growers would take fire blight cuttings, and if those cuttings brushed another tree on the way out of the orchard, you would spread, and then all of a sudden you would have stripes of fire blight. It was awful. So again, we're learning more and more and more about things that we thought we were experts on and how to manage them. In the past, my first couple years cutting out fire blight, we used to carry coffee cans of bleach on our hips, and we would sanitize the cutters between every single cut.
Oh,
because
the thought was that it
would spread the bacteria.
Right.
If you happen to make a bad cut that you cut into bacteria-infected tissue, you'd be spreading it. And I don't know, one of the extension agencies figured out that that wasn't actually the case. So everybody stopped dipping their cutters, and with no real increased infection. And again, that kind of ties into IPM, where you've always got to be kind of understanding every action that you take matters. Everything, every cut you make, how you cut, when you mow, when you monitor, when you spray. It's a very complex, fascinating system. And I think as humans, we like to think we know everything.
No,
we don't.
No,
Michael,
everything is always changing.
Exactly.
So Michael Phillips would mow, I think it was maybe 2 weeks after petal fall. I don't remember when the first flush was going to happen to pulse the energy up into the tree.
Yep.
Is that still done, or is that done through IPM as well?
Mowing is interesting, because I'm really glad you brought this up. A lot of growers are mowing is just, well, it's landscaping. You just mow when the grass is tall to make it look pretty, and that's that. And as we know, thanks to people like Michael Phillips, that's not the case. There's different schools of thought on that. So say you have a totally grassed orchard like we do at Risk of Brook, no herbicide strips.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to try to control the density of the sod. You don't want to be cutting the grass too much, or the sod gets too dense, robs too much water from the trees, takes up all the nutrients. Cutting when there's the first big flush of spring growth makes a lot of sense. If you mow at just the right time, it will reduce that competition of nutrients between the tree and the, I don't want to say weeds, but because not everything is a weed, the species on the orchard floor.
Yeah.
Because orchard floor management, soil health, is super exciting. It's something that I don't know a lot about, that I'm trying to actively learn a lot more about, because these soil microbiomes that exist under the orchard are actually hugely beneficial to these sterilized herbicide strips that, the fertilizer runs right through that soil, but the negative effects of that sterilized soil are outweighing the benefit of the synthetic fertilizer that's being put down. So in terms of timing your mowing to make that ground cover as helpful as possible for soil health, tree health, makes the most sense to me. But like in any IPM system, I like to play devil's advocate. You think about every action that you take that has a benefit, you think about the potential negative effects. So I think there's a big practice in a lot of growers, that a lot of the conventional growers, that have picked up the idea of mowing dandelions in the spring to benefit pollination. If there's open dandelions during full bloom, you're trying to reduce the pollination competition from the pollinators moving from dandelions to the tree.
To the tree, yeah.
And reducing potential toxicity of insecticides that are on the dandelions. Say you spray an insecticide post-bloom, if you've got open dandelions, that's still a risk. So there's kind of that double-edged sword where you're trying to time your mowing to benefit soil health and what's good for the tree and also the pollinators. And it's really hard to know what to do, because for years I was a big fan of mowing dandelions during bloom and during the spring. And now I think we're discovering that native pollinators, if you have a strong native pollinator species, which I think at Risk as we do, you can physically see it compared to other orchards I've worked at, in part because we're surrounded by hundreds of acres of woods.
Yeah.
So good habitat. So I'm less worried about pollination competition from dandelions. I'm very conscious about what we're spraying during time when there's open dandelions. In terms of the scale of factors of everything that you do, the timing of mowing for soil health is beginning to outweigh my concern for pollination competition.
And also the dandelions often seem to bloom first because they're blooming in April and we don't get bloom until May here.
See that, I'm glad you said that because I did not see a lot of dandelions at risk as I was anticipated during full bloom. And in my mind, I don't know if that was a timing thing or there's just not a lot of dandelions in the orchard.
They might have been there earlier. I'm not sure.
They could have been.
I think ours are, aren't there usually April,
yeah,
mid-April? And I don't think the bloom happened till May. I mean, our few trees face northeast, so it's a little cooler. But
yeah. Which is great, because then the timing works out to the pollinator's benefit.
Yeah, they move from the dandelion to the apple blooms.
Yep. It's all really fascinating. And that problem doesn't go away. Right now, there's a lot of red clover in bloom.
Right, right.
And so I was thinking about starting to mow again this week, in part because with the recent rains we had a pause in rain, so the grass really wasn't growing as fast, which is great. I said, okay, you don't have to worry about it. Figure out what's going on. With the recent rain, the grass is getting really dense. And unfortunately, there is the consideration that our machine won't be able to handle really dense, thick, moist grass. Because we're a large enough orchard, we can't hand scythe. If I had a crew, we could do that. But we have a wonderful orchard mower that is actually made to mow around the tree trunks from Italy. That's a really specialized mower for orchards that do not have herbicide strips. So that's, again, in the scale of factors you have to weigh and consider, is the grass getting too dense and too tall physically for the machine to handle? So I'm trying to wait as long as I possibly can to mow again because I'm seeing so much clover bloom. Trying to also factor in what I'm seeing in the bug traps, which is influencing the decision of if I need to spray anything and when I would need to spray that. So I'm looking ahead to next week, looking at apple maggot counts, peeking in the traps every couple days.
This was recorded in late July.
I don't take my official counts until every 7 days, but I like to peek in the traps a couple times a week to know where the trends are going and try to predict, okay, if I need to spray next week, if I need to do an insecticide for apple maggot, then maybe I should mow before then. Or vice versa. If I don't need to spray for apple maggot, then the mowing can wait.
It's, I see what you're saying, because you'll hurt the pollinators
if you
spray
exactly
when things are in bloom.
Exactly. And that, of course, depends on what goes in the tank. Will the clover still be in bloom next week? This Rubik's Cube of decisions that all intertwine and affect each other. That's IPM, being conscious of what's going on with everything all at once, instead of just, I have a bug, it's causing damage, I'm going to go use a broad-spectrum insecticide that I know will work.
No.
That is not modern orcharding anymore.
No. It seems like they take a lot more consideration into what is that going to do to the entire environment.
What are your biggest challenges? Do you have curculio here?
Yes. Of all the pests that we are monitoring and controlling for, some are omnipresent. They're just always there every year. You can count on them. Some of them are localized populations. Every orchard is completely different. No two are alike. So the management practices are different. So coddling moth is an example of not all orchards have to control coddling moth. It just does not exist at some orchards. Why? I don't know. Those growers are very lucky.
We didn't have them in California.
And that's something we should also talk about, are the growing conditions. The Pacific Northwest versus Michigan and Western New York versus New England, because New England is the most challenging place to grow tree fruit in the country because it's now warm and warmer. It's always been humid, which just causes fungal stuff to run off the charts, fire blight infections and everything. Curculio is something that it's an opportunist. It's always there every year. It's very destructive if left uncontrolled, and it lives in the borders of the orchard, in the woods, and every year, just the right time, it knows it's a weevil. It jumps out of the woods, and it makes those classic C-shaped scars on the surface of the fruit. It's one of those pests that, okay, it really just makes a superficial scar. If it's really bad, and you get a lot of scars per fruit, and they can start to kind of cause that cone of rot behind the skin, then that's not great. But say you have an orchard that you know is going to be harvested just for cider, that may not be an issue.
Right.
So it all kind of depends on what your end use is. But curculio is fascinating because we're learning a lot more about it than we knew. We don't currently have a way to monitor for it that I'm aware of. There's no pheromone lures or pheromone disruption. I don't know why. I'm sure somebody's working on it.
That's crazy because when you hear apples in New England, next thing is coddling moth.
And coddling moth is a huge problem in orchards
and
where
curculio.
It's a problem. Curculio's,
and curculio.
Curculio is one of, I think both. It's one of the most economically destructive. And by destructive, I mean fruit that needs to be absolutely perfect for supermarket sales, which is a whole nother.
But don't they hatch and go into the apple sometimes, or not always?
I think they hatch. I think they feed right there in the surface of the fruit, and then they jump out of the fruit and they go down into the soil.
Oh.
And the larvae overwinter.
We're talking curculio
in the soil.
Again, because I confused when I said cotton. Yeah. Curculio.
But something really exciting about curculio is that at UMass Amherst, Dr. Jaime Pinheiro, I believe this was started by Ron Procopi. I could be wrong about that. Somebody will correct me. So curculio, the current methods are to spray for it. We haven't figured out a better way to control it. Dr. Pinheiro is working on something called the Trap Tree Project, which is a type of attract and kill method, kind of like the apple maggot spheres we were talking about before. This is fascinating. This is something that I totally nerd out about. So
I love it.
It's called the Trap Tree Project. So if you think about plum curculio living in the edges of the orchard, right, its most damage is done on the orchard borders. If it gets bad enough, it moves into the center of the block and infects fruit in the middle of the block. So one of the original tactics was to just do border sprays of insecticide to lessen the use of insecticide in the orchard. And that does work, depending on what you use and when you use it. Again, degree day timing, because we know that after 308 degree days, curculio is gone, its life cycle's over, you just need to worry about it till then. So the Trap Tree Project, there's been a lot of research done to figure out which cultivars curculio is the most attracted to. So they had a list of 6 cultivars a few years ago. I think it's actually dwindled down to 2 or 3.
So what are those?
Astrakhan, I think Wixen, and the Ginger Gold was on the list, but I think they've taken it off, and there's one more I'm forgetting. The idea is they're taking trees on the perimeter of an orchard block at a certain spacing. Say your rows are 25 foot by 10 foot tree spacing. You're doing across the rows, like every third tree, and then down the row, every 6th tree, whatever it is. And they're grafting those 3 varieties onto that tree. Now you've got these hot spots on the edges of the orchard that curculio is going to be the most attracted to. So even if you've got curculio that finds its way to the center of the block, these trees are
Ones that are going to grab them.
Exactly. They're acting like magnets. So the curculio are going to go lay their eggs in those trees first, okay? That concept is fascinating unto itself, that we've actually figured out what it prefers.
Red Astrakhan, what was the other one?
Wixen.
Wixen.
And I wish I remember what the third one was.
It's all right.
Not Ginger Gold?
Yeah, I think Ginger Gold was, but it's not as much of an attractant as the other two, because he's basically dwindled it down to what's going to be the most effective.
Wow.
Because again, it has to be practical to a grower. So if you have to go out and graft trees, grafting 2 varieties onto your sacrificial tree versus 6, not to mention, again, the fire blight potential of these varieties can be through the roof, especially Red Astrakhan and Wixen. Again, it all kind of ties into each other and feeds into itself. But I think that trying to control fire blight on just those handfuls of trees is worth the sacrifice trying to.
The fire blight would be attracted to the Red Astrakhan as well as the curculio?
The varieties themselves are just inherently more susceptible to fire blight. I could be wrong about Red Astrakhan.
Okay.
I believe Wixen is highly susceptible. So
because Red Astrakhan is an early bloomer. I was surprised it would be.
So it may not be. I could be wrong about
it. It's an early bearer. I don't know if it's an early bloomer also, but
oddly enough, there are some varieties that bloom really early, like Eider Red,
right.
And they harvest super late. It's all because
it's all over the map. So I'll have to check a bloom chart for Astrakhan.
Exactly.
One of my favorite apples, and it makes a nice pink applesauce.
Yes,
you could probably make acceptable applesauce with curculio scars on it. You wouldn't even notice.
Totally could. You totally could.
Yeah, so it's a good sauce apple.
So that's called the Trap Tree Project. That's just the first half of it. Because the idea originally was to attract the curc to those trees.
Right.
And then instead of spraying insecticide across the whole orchard, you just spray those trees. And that fruit is usually bad at that point. It's been infected. You could pick it for cider if you wanted. Do whatever you want with it. Or you could not spray those trees. And this is what Dr. Pinheiro is still currently working on. And I volunteered us to participate in this project for next season. I was too late this year to graft the trap trees, but for next season, I think I'm talking with him about trying to participate in this. So now, instead of just spraying those trap trees, UMass Extension, Dr. Pinheiro has done research into figuring out a specific species of nematode that prefers to feed on, I believe it's the larvae of the curculio, that again, jump out of the fruit and they overwinter in the soil. So instead of spraying the trap trees, you let the curculio live out its life cycle, lay its eggs, the larvae hatch, and they drop into the ground below that tree. So now you've got this concentration of curculio larvae in the soil below your trap trees. The idea is to apply these nematodes underneath those trees to kill the kirk.
Now, I have a question about the nematodes.
Mm-hmm.
Would they be anything that would upset the bees?
Good question. I don't know. I don't, off the top of my head, I don't see.
But they're soil-living creatures.
Yeah. Right.
Well, you know, well, I know because sometimes the bees get close to the soil and they get close to the...
Well, they're native pollinators that nest in the soil too.
Right.
My
right.
understanding, we've had quite a few seminars about this over the last couple of years, and my very loose understanding at the moment is that it's a very specific species of nematode that highly prefers Curculio. It's fascinating.
That is fascinating.
It's fascinating. Yeah. It's really cool.
I want to invite them to my dinner table, little nematodes.
And for those listening, if this sounds like, oh, well, this is just a really distant one-off project, I think there's 12 or 13 farms in New England that have trap trees that are actively participating. Because it's a very slow learning curve, right?
Sure.
You try these
methods. It actually sounds like an episode of Men in Black.
Yeah, it does. It does. It totally does. You've got to find the bugs and figure out where they are and take care of them. Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating. So that's something that looking at Curculio going, okay, we don't have mating disruption. It's really hard to deal with. It can be very economically damaging if we were wholesaling fruit. And that is something coming down the road that has been coming down the road for a few years now that is looking promising. But again, probably the most applicable to a certain size farm. A 1,000-acre orchard in Michigan or New York may not
do the nematode business.
Every farm's different, you know.
Sure.
If you've got Wayne County, New York, is nothing but orchards and orchards and orchards.
Right.
So
you'd have to do so many trees.
How does that work? And if all of a sudden you've got these hot spots of Curculio, maybe my thinking is backwards, but you don't have a lot of habitat for them to begin with if you have no forest. If
right,
it's nothing
right.
but the monocrop.
So the orchard is their habitat.
It's tricky. So, and that's kind of why I go back to some of these solutions are not applicable across the entire apple industry. It probably works great for backyard orchardists. It probably works great for small to medium sized like us.
Yep.
Maybe not for true blue wholesale commercial orchards because there's still that end of the industry that grows fruit on a massive scale for consumption by those who do not live in an area like we do, where we have right, small right. local farms to buy directly from your neighbor.
How fantastic would that be for that to work?
Oh, it's fascinating.
And then you just, you know,
it's fascinating.
You can get your
yep.
fingers off the
yep.
sprays.
Yep.
And you know, the irony of all of our crazy, challenging weather conditions mm-hmm. to produce fruit is that, okay, maybe I'm biased, but I always feel that our fruit is the sweetest and the best in the Northeast. I really do. It really had to work for it. You know?
Yep. Soil type has a great deal to do with that, I believe. We think about the different densities and types of soil and what's living in the soil, what's mm-hmm. competing for nutrients, what soil fungi are actually helping the trees and beneficials. I think of the water taken up by the tree as the blood, in a way.
Yes.
So the rate at which that's taken up, depending on the nutrient density in the soil, definitely directly affects the finished product, the fruit, the size, the flavor, the color. There's a noticeable difference. 2 years ago, we had the severely dry season. We had almost no rain. There was no green grass in the orchard. And the year before that was the 35 inches of rain that June. And there was a very noticeable difference in the fruit quality. The size, number one, the flavor. The waterlogged fruit definitely had significantly less flavor. I tell a lot of people that. They go, oh, so the apples were huge in the wet year and tiny in the dry year. And it was actually the opposite. The fruit in the wet year were marbles because the trees were, their roots were so saturated with water. There's no oxygen in the soil.
They couldn't move.
They could not move. It was very noticeable. And then in the following year, the dry year, the fruit was not large, but it was larger than the wettest year on record. So,
and it was probably a lot sweeter.
It was. It absolutely was. The sugars were way more concentrated.
I'm looking forward to how you're going to have.
What kind of bricks are you going for? Because I think we tested that
California.
Fruit. California. We had a tree, a dry farm tree that tested at 24. I mean, it was insane.
Wow. Oh my
God. It was candy. It was candy.
I think I'm not an expert in that. Once you start talking about bricks and other things.
Here we had like 11 or something.
I think 10 is typically the sweet spot. No pun intended.
Yeah, no, in New England, ours was like 10 or 11, and I think Riska's was similar.
And it depends on the end use, right? Like I know if I have friends who make hard cider who have always wanted me to kind of get into that world, and I always say, I know nothing about, I should at this point in time, but I don't. I like to grow fruit for edible consumption. Apples are super
right.
They're good for
they're
you. They
awesome.
Make you feel good. If you have a headache, have an apple, it goes away. I mean, so in terms of the factors of different varieties and the quality of fruit that affect cider are so different than fresh eating varieties. And there's some that are good at both, which is really fascinating too.
I know that we've covered a lot of the scab, the curculio, the coddling moth, the fire blight, the apple maggot.
I didn't ask what the biggest pressures this year were.
This year, that's a great question, actually. I had anticipated coddling moth to be super high pressure and scab to be off the charts. And scab was definitely very high pressure. We had a lot sneak through. Not an alarming amount, but again, we're willing to live with a certain amount instead of having a perfectly clean orchard. There's scab out there. And it's going to be big infection sites for next year, but not out of control. We can live with it. It's no big deal. Coddling moth has not been an issue. So I think kind of driving the bus at this point, so to speak, as a good friend calls it. You know, when you think about all these pests, it's a great term to quantify who's driving the bus right now. Scab, fire blight, coddling moth, curculio. Right now, as of this morning, the apple maggot counts in two of the traps are beginning to get high. Not above the threshold at which I'd be concerned, but I'm keeping an eye on it. It's about the right time of year for that to happen. It's not quite August yet, so we have a little bit more time to go before we really start picking. Otherwise, there was really nothing this year that was a massive concern. Fire blight was on my radar to start the season because our trees, we gave them a pretty good haircut last year. They had been under pruned for a while, so Calvin, one of the new owners, did a great job at pruning the orchard, just totally gave the trees what they needed, and they now have a lot of vegetative growth. And vegetative growth can also be bad for fire blight infection if it gets in the tree. So I was super nervous about that, and then as soon as fire blight passed, curculio pressure started out higher than I had anticipated. I saw a lot of scarring earlier than I had anticipated. And then, like clockwork, at 308 degree days, it stopped. It ebbs and flows, right? Depending on what's going on when, because nothing is omnipresent the whole season.
Right.
So that's why I say right now is a little bit nice and relaxing because a lot of the major issues we're past. So the biggest concern at this point would definitely be the H word, the magic ice that falls from the sky. That can happen at any time. That, again, we're seeing these erratic storms in early June. I think you guys had some right here.
Some hail.
And it wasn't at the orchard. And that was scary. And then I've seen it wipe out crops in September. I mean, knock on wood. But that's the kind of concern that there's so little you can do about it that it's almost not worth worrying about.
So in a perfect world where weather is going to be lovely for the next couple of months, what can we look forward to seeing coming to fruition? Those apple trees in which varieties?
Macintosh.
Plenty of Macintosh.
Good. I love it when people say Mac's their favorite. They're one of my favorites.
Yeah.
I mean,
great.
I remember growing up with about six of them and a book.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I'm happy.
Yep. It's
the classic
school lunch apple in New England.
Yeah. Best.
And whenever I hear people that say, oh, I don't like Macintosh, they're mushy. It's because you've never had,
had
fresh
a real
off the
one.
Tree. They are so different fresh off the tree. It's a phenomenal apple. It's also a much easier apple to grow. It's certainly hardier. It crops on a regular basis. It's not prone to biennial bearing.
Gorgeous flesh.
It's got gorgeous flesh. There's just different sub-varieties of Macintosh that are beautiful, like Ruby Mac has a dark maroon skin all the way around. It's got no green side. The flavor is similar. It's got a slightly pink flesh. It's still a Macintosh.
Grow them over there?
No. Maybe we'll plant some someday, but
That'd be awesome.
You've got to delineate between Ruby Macintosh and Pioneer Macintosh and Marshall Macs and all.
Do you know who you've got over there? What Macs you got over there?
I don't. It's a, I call it a fairly regular Mac. It's probably
like a
Pioneer or just old-fashioned regular Macintosh. And that's kind of the tricky part about jumping into an orchard with really no records, no prior history, learning on the go.
That is so
figuring
cool.
it out. You get to tell throughout the year.
Are you thinking of adding some of the resistant varieties like Liberty and also one of my favorites is Ashmead's Kernel.
Glad to hear it because just yesterday we were looking at where a potential new orchard's gonna go in the spring and I was coming up with the list of potential varieties to go in. Top of the list were Liberty, Keepsake, Ashmead's Kernel, the Roxbury Russet from Roxbury, Massachusetts.
I was going to say Golden Russet. Orange Russet.
Yeah, Cox Orange Pippin.
That's it. I love that one.
The russets are fascinating because
all the russets are
they're good.
Yeah.
They're really good.
Oh,
they're good. And
so good.
Where I was working previously, we were about an hour outside Boston. So we had a lot of foot traffic, a lot of people that were not as familiar with the what I think of as the less popular varieties. You had a lot of people that just wanted Honeycrisp, and that's great.
Right, right.
But we had an oddball row. We top grafted one tree to each one of those oddball varieties. The russets, I think we had an Ashmead's Kernel, Wolf River, all sorts of fun stuff. So we only had 5 or 6 bushels of each. And we let people sample them, and they love them. They go, what is this? You know, we don't care about the russeting skin. It tastes so good. And these more old-fashioned varieties are often hardier.
I was just going to say.
In some cases, they're more disease-resistant. Not always. Depends on the variety.
True.
So that's in part of trying to plant this new orchard. It's not as simple as, I want that variety, I want that variety.
Right
now, we have from what seems like a relatively low fire blight pressure in that orchard. So being very conscious of what varieties we choose, because I don't want to choose the fire blight magnets and all of a sudden bring it in, and then it's going to jump to the Gala and the Fuji, the existing susceptible varieties. So I'm still doing the homework on what would make the most sense to plant. But there's tens of thousands of varieties that are just, it's a fascinating world. It goes on. And there's one variety from my hometown in Massachusetts that was discovered in my hometown that I know nothing about. It's probably not a good growing apple.
What's your hometown?
Bolton, Massachusetts.
I've heard of Westfield, further, which I wasn't crazy about. I liked it okay.
I was just reading about that yesterday.
And Hubbardston's Nonsuch,
I think that's a decent one. That's a good one.
That's a great orange pippin. For a year, we used to work at the apple tasting booth in California.
Oh, nice.
And we had so many varieties. And of course, Bill and I loved it because we're apple freaks.
And I got to know what to get at the Scion Exchange in the spring.
Yes.
Yeah, nice, awesome.
And it was fantastic. I just loved it because I got all those apples.
I have a cool tie to apples in California that you guys may appreciate. So I have two former coworkers, we all work together in Vermont, who have a strong background in cider making and wine making, but they're both originally from Northern California, Humboldt County. And they were describing these Red Delicious trees to me, and they were sending me pictures. Those aren't Red Delicious. What are you talking about? And they went, yes, they are. They're the original Red Delicious before they were bred for typiness and shelf full color, and it's a completely different apple when it was.
They called them Standard Delicious where I was in the Anderson Valley.
They called them Standard Delicious.
They were not solid red. They were more striped,
yep.
I think.
Yep, yeah. with kind of a yellow background.
I think so, yeah. They
were
good.
And they're delicious. Good. When are we getting apples?
The first week or two of September will be Macintosh.
Yes.
Followed by the Cortlands.
That's my second.
We have a limited amount of Honeycrisp, but they are there and they're looking good. They'll probably be mid to late September. Don't quote me on it. And
that's
then
okay.
Macallan's, my personal favorite, between the end of September, early October, depending again on the weather, precise timing, because I'm a super particular Macallan picker. They have to be picked at just the right time to be good. Small amount of Braeburn, some Spencers, which are good. Empire, Ida Red to round out the season. Gala and Fuji. Plenty of Gala, tons of them. Both very good apples. Galas are personal.
But those first three, the Macallan, the Cortlands, the Max, those are my favorites. I think of them as the old New England apples,
and I don't think any of them are from New England. Macintosh is Canadian, I believe. The parent tree is or did exist in Canada. I believe Cortland's from either Cortland, New York, or it was a Geneva variety.
Oh.
Macallan's Arkansas Black crossed with Macintosh, I think. So that's a crossbred one from where, I don't remember. Honeycrisp is from Minnesota, of course. Its claim to fame.
It's a good one.
Empire. You can probably guess what state that's from.
Jeez.
Cornell has been key in developing varieties, research, everything apple. Cornell is one of the top universities in the world.
Yeah.
That's good to know. That's really good to know. I would love to revisit this because we are going to discuss the taste and the crop that happens. We're going to do a crop show.
And maybe we'll make a trip to Tower Hill and find some of the old varieties.
Yes, great idea. I heard they got hit by fire blight pretty hard that they had to replant.
They had to replant, but I think it's going again. It's near Worcester. It's Boylston.
Yep.
Yeah.
How would people reach you to ask you questions?
For the orchard, you would have to go to the Riskabrook Orchard website. R-I-I-S-K-A. Brook. Two words. B-R-O-O-K. Orchard. And we are at 101 New Hartford Road in Sandusfield, Massachusetts.
And you're open weekends, other times?
Weekends, I believe we'll be open during the week for picking too.
And this will be September, October, really.
Yep, September, October, yep.
When the show broadcasts, it's probably going to be over. So
correct.
How was blueberry season?
Very good. Better than we'd anticipated. Better than last year.
Do you have a lot of pests with blueberries?
Yes. It's not quite as bad as apples because they seem to be so much more native to New England. They're pretty hardy. I didn't spray them at all this year. I kind of let them do their own thing. We're anticipating on planting potentially some more next year or the year after. The idea is to have the blueberry season roll right into peach season in August, which will roll right into apple season.
And you have peaches too?
We just planted the first trees this spring. They're tiny.
We were just talking with Joe Pappas of Riska Brook Orchard. Their website is RISKABrookOrchard.com. They also have a Facebook page. Look up their name, Riska Brook Orchard. Their phone number is 413-707-3927. That's 413-707-3927. This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org, where you can also donate to support local talk, music, and other local programming on this great station. Thanks for listening.